Good morning. Today is May 23rd, 2006. We're the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team. And today it's approximately 9:20 a.m. And we're here to interview Rocky Wright. First, we'll introduce the team.
Cheryl McQuaid.
John Fedewa.
Jerry Smith.
And I'm Doug Rademacher. Would you please state your name and spell it for us?
Rocky Wright. Better known as Rocky Wright anyway. The real name is Wendell Wright, W-E-N-D-E-L-L-W-R-I-G-H-T.
And what is your address?
1902 Shore Drive, Orleans, Michigan, 48865.
And are you married?
Yes, I am. 46 years.
And do you have any children?
Two.
Are they boys or girls?
Two girls.
Okay. Rocky, where were you born and raised?
I was born in Hartley, Kentucky, and I came here at the age of 15 from Kentucky and lived on Jerome Street and went to school at Eastern High School.
Okay. What is your education level?
I have some college through General Motors classes, graduated in high school in 58, and because I missed about a half a year there. Then I took some courses through GM over at GMI in Flint.
All right. And were you in the military?
No, I wasn't.
What did your parents do for a living?
My dad was a coal miner. My mother was a housewife.
Okay. What did you do before you hired in at Fisher Body?
I was a cook in the Lansing area, different restaurants. One of the ones that really comes back to mind is Home Dairy Company. I was a second cook and probably one of the largest catering outfits around Lansing, anywhere.
Where was that located?
That was located on Washington Avenue, downtown Lansing. Okay. And we ran a cafeteria there, a delicatessen, bakery. I worked on the third floor doing all the food for the cafeteria. And then when we had the catering jobs, we'd work all night sometimes. And at Thanksgiving, we'd do maybe 400 turkeys, stuffed turkeys, and people would pick them up just the night before Thanksgiving. Quite an experience.
Just for my own interest, where is that on Washington Avenue?
That was just south of the Michigan Theater, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
It's quite a big building.
All right. Would you please tell us, why did you hire into Fisher Body?
Well, I'll tell you, I loved cooking, but I couldn't make the living that I wanted to make. So I hired in at GM because that looked like the best place to work at that time. And then I could work weekends or whatever at the cooking business.
So you wanted more money, but you decided to work two jobs for a while.
Yes, and I did that.
When did you hire into Fisher Body?
May 16th, 1963.
How did you know they were hiring?
I had a couple of neighbors talking that they were going to be hiring, so I took off over here and put in an application, and within two or three days I got called.
Did you have to stand in line, or was there a group of people at that time, or did you just show up and walk right in?
I basically walked right in because I don't know if it was the wrong time or the right time of day or what, but there was very few people filling out apps at that time. But shortly after that, they really were hiring. I mean, everything that walked through the door, practically, they were hiring at that time. But there was really not that big a crowd when I came in and filled out the application.
And do you remember where you went?
Yes, the old Fisher Body plant went down in the main entrance and up to the and around the corner to the old employment office.
Okay, and do you remember what your what that was like? Was there physical or what kind of things?
Well, it was kind of remind you of a dungeon, really. It was very dark and not any windows or anything, and it looked like an office and it was clean and everything, but it just seemed strange to me, you know, that everything was below ground level. And Then I remember going upstairs when I came back to get a physical. I had to go upstairs and get a physical. But that was on the main floor. And that area must have moved, I don't know how many times, a half a dozen in my career there.
How old were you when you hired him?
23.
What shift and what department did you first work?
I started on days in the cushion room and worked 41 days and got, or worked 89 days and got laid off.
Well, before I get you to the 89th day and ask you why that's a special thing, tell me about, you've been a cook, you've came in, you've been accepted for work. Would you please share, you saw the dungeon where you filled out your paperwork, the day they brought you in. Can you describe what you saw and what it felt like when you saw the assembly line for the first time and your first day on the job?
Well, they brought me in and took me up to a supervisor's office, and they talked to us and told us a little bit what was going to take place and what we did in this area and in the cushion room, and I was overwhelmed, really, with how many seats they were building running down that line. And so I was, you know, I wasn't real young, but I wasn't a kid 18 years old, but I tell you, it was kind of scary what she's going to have to do to make that money, you know. And if I remember right, it was only about $2.29 an hour or something like that.
Were you welcomed by the people when you went up to that? Assembly line?
Yes, I was.
Now, the cushion was a separate area. Did you see the automobile assembly line on your way there?
No, I didn't. They took us through the hallways, and you could hear the things going on, and I guess was the body shop and stuff, but cushion room was located in building 15 over on off Michigan Avenue, and right next to the shipping building 17, and we didn't see any real production areas, because they took us through the office area and across by layout and stuff like that to get us over there. But then I really was scared when they finally got me upstairs and showed me where everything was being put together. That was awesome.
It was awesome.
It was awesome. I said, Lord, have mercy, what did I get into here?
Now, you've shared getting taken to your job. You said the people welcomed you. Can you share that first day? What did they have you do, and what was it like? Was there a race to learn the job? Or did?
It was completely new to me, what I'd been doing all my 23 years of life. And I remember this lady breaking me in on zigzag. And I don't know if you guys even know what zigzag is, but zigzag is where you put the springs together for the cushions and then brought this big gun down and put the clips on the springs to hold them together, you know, before you put the jute and the pad and all on for the cushion. And she showed me two or three of them, what to do and how many clips to put on and what have you, and I took over. But boy, I'll tell you, by the time I got done that day, this little guy was tired.
And was this a hard on the hands, or was it just strenuous, or was it just repetitiveness? What wore you out?
Basically, it was hard on your shoulder and hand, because you're pulling the gun down. It was on a balancer of some kind. You pull the gun down and then pull the trigger. So, but anything new like that was definitely going to make you sore and tired. But I hung with her.
Okay, well, now share that you did that and you went on to this 89 days. You say you got laid off?
Well, things slowed down, I guess you might say, and they started cutting people and doing things different, slowing down the line and stuff, and they laid me off at 89 days. And I had to get 90 days in order to get the benefits and establish seniority. So I'm pretty sad when they laid me off, you know, because I had become pretty good at what I was doing, and had moved around a couple of times and different jobs, and I hated to go back to that cooking full time, but I left. I'm sad, but I left, and I thought that was the end of it. And 41 days later, I got called back, and I had to quit my job again. But I don't know. You guys may not know Jerry Brooks, but Jerry Brooks was the employment supervisor at that time. And he called me and he says, "Rock, I got a job for you." He says, "It looks pretty good." He says, "But you'll have to work nights." And I said, "No, I ain't working nights. I got a job. I'm working straight days, and I guess I'll just stay here." He says, "Well," he says, "we really need you. We really need your help." And he says, "Come in on days then, Monday." Okay, I'll do that. So I came in on days, and I had been laid off for the 41 days, so now I got to work on this 90-day thing again, you know. And I got up to 88 days, and they laid me off again. And boy, I am fired up now. I mean, I'm hot. Because now I got to go see if I can get a job back cooking again. But anyway, I left again, and I was only off 37 days, if I remember the numbers right. And he calls me up again, and he says, "I got a job for you, but you'll have to work nights." I said, "Jerry, don't tell me I got to work nights, because I ain't coming back to work nights." He says, "Okay, fine." And he hung up. I thought that was the end of it. A couple days later, he called me back. He says, "All right, come in on days. Can you be here tomorrow morning?" I said, "Jerry, I can't just walk out on these people. You know, I'm cooking upstairs here, and they need me." And he says, "Okay, I think this was on Wednesday, maybe." I said, "I can be there Monday." He said, "Make it Friday." I said, "I don't know if I can do it." He said, "Make it Friday, or I'm just going to forget you." So I says, "Okay, I'll be there Friday." So I went in at midnight at my cooking job and got everything ready for the cafeteria, and I was here at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I was never laid off after that, except for changeover.
Did you continue to work the two jobs for a little while?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
So you didn't let them go?
Well, in fact, I worked three jobs. I worked at Fisher Body 40 hours a week, and I cooked about 20 hours a week. And I worked weekends at Texaco Gas Station right across from Gorslin Rossman Funeral Home on Saturday and Sunday. I did that for over 2 years.
And this time you, every time back to the cushion room, or where were you at?
Yes, I went back to the cushion room there until we started running seat belts. I put in a transfer to go up and trim, and I moved up to trim and started installing seat belts.
Okay, you spoke about seeing that assembly line with the autos on it, and you said it was awesome.
Oh, it was.
So tell me about going to the seatbelt job, and how awesome was that?
Well, when I saw that, I'm thinking, how in the world do you put all these bolts and screws in every one of these locations? You know, every body that comes through there has got to have one. And it don't take you long to figure out how to do it. Because you get down at the end of that hose, and that is tough work down there. But the more you can stay up the line, the better off you are. I mean, you get the shot at it right away. So it was a new experience, but I worked it out. And I had a little trouble with my arm running that gun, but that's the way it was, you know.
Do you remember who taught you that, John?
Well, let's see. I think maybe that might have been, I think the hourly guy might have been Keith, oh goodness, forgive me, but.
Well, it don't matter. I just wondered if that person treated you good, if he made it
really
easy for you.
He treated me really good, and he showed me some of the shortcuts of how to get there and not be down the line all the time. That's the worst thing you can do, is be down the line. And I know from being an hourly, you know, I fought jobs and was a member of 602 local. fighting the job because they were kind of add on all the time, you know. You know how that goes. But he just was, I think he was glad to teach me because I think he was kind of a utility guy, you know, and he didn't like that job either. And so he wanted me to catch on right away so he could get off of it.
What's a utility job? What's that do?
Well, at that time, it was extra people that when a Doug Rademacher don't show up for work, he might be doing your job that day. Or I wouldn't show up, he'd be doing my job. So they called them utility people back then. It got different later on.
Did you have any other family members that worked at Fisher Body?
Not at that time. Later on, after I had went to salary, my brother came in here to work, and I did not get him hired in, but he hired in on his own. But I did have a son-in-law that I talked him into coming here, and he still works for General Motors.
Thinking back to your early days, do you remember any new hire initiations or pranks played on you?
Oh, yes, quite a few of them, to be honest with you.
Could you say so?
I didn't fall for all of them, but some of them I did. And, you know, that went on. I don't care who you were. And sooner or later, they're going to get you for one. And I can remember one that these guys all got together in a little, what we called a smoking area in a cushion room because everything was so flammable. Over there, you had to go to this room if you smoked. And they said, hey, Rock, he says, you know, it's almost Thanksgiving. And he says, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, if you go over to the employment office at 4 o'clock, they will give you a turkey. And so, you know, naive, dumb, or whatever you want to call it. Well, so I started asking around, you know, some of the people that didn't play pranks and stuff, and they just kind of grinned. I thought, uh-oh, something is wrong here. So I go back and I tell this guy that told me this story. I said, by the way, we've already bought our turkey, and we don't have a freezer to put it in, so you just take my badge number and go over there and get it for yourself. And he said, well, I'm already getting one. I said, well, get two of them. You got a big family of liars.
Got him right off. Caught him on that one, huh?
But there was more than that they tried to pull, I'll tell you. There was some real dirty tricks that some guys pulled. Yeah, they were almost sickening. But we got through it.
You don't want to share one of those sickening ones?
Well, I can tell you one that was I won't mention any names of who did it because I thought it was really sick. But this one gal that hired in, and like I said, I won't mention any names. She was working on a line up there, and one of the guys told her, hey, go back and tell your foreman there, listen to him talk about his kid. He just won a skating contest in the Olympics. There's no Olympics going on, but she was real naive, and she goes back and she says to the supervisor, says, hey, I hear that you have a real talented son that won a skating contest in the Olympics. He said, what are you talking about? My son don't have any legs.
Oh,
that was
no.
The sickest thing I ever heard in my life. But that was some of the stuff that they came up with.
And those guys thought that was funny, didn't they?
They thought it was funny, and she just broke down and cried like crazy. And she wouldn't even talk to those people for a long time after that. That's a bad joke, really.
Oh, that's painful for all the parties.
Yeah.
Do you remember the people you hired in with, or did you hire in alone? Did you come in a group?
I came in with a group, but I can hardly remember the names or anything. But there was a lot of people came in there right around that time. They started in April, I think, hiring and trying to fill the place up so they could speed up the lines or something. And, I remember a lot of people, but to tell you the names, I just can't.
So you hired in and out a few times, but you don't hang out or keep contact with people you hired in with originally back in the in those days?
No, not really, because I moved out of town, you know, as soon as I retired, and we used to do some things together, like the Jerry Chamberlains and I and the Frank Mize and people like that, even Ron Allman. We used to do a little drinking together, I guess you'd call it.
Recreating?
Recreating.
Uh-huh.
Lip wedding.
Tell us about your work life at Fisher Body. What was the environment like inside the plant, and what was a typical day like?
Well, when I first started, the typical day was just come in and do your job for 8 hours and go home tired. But then we started running what they call the Astrodome wagon. You remember that? Where all the folding seats were built offline, and I got into building the second seat. And that thing had a ton of hardware on it, and it was heavy, and they wanted us to work 10 and 12 hours a day because they were selling every one of them. The Astrodome was the one that had the raised roof with the glass across the front of it.
Oh, the Vista Cruiser.
Vista Cruiser. When we first started running, it was called the Astrodome, but then they changed it to the Vista Cruiser.
Oh, so that was called the Astrodome?
Early on, I didn't know yes. That. And that was a trying job, but it was awful hard work and heavy work. But I did that for quite some time. And there was a real trick to skinning covers, too. I became what we was talking about a little bit ago, a utility guy in a cushion room. And when you first started skinning covers, on whether it was backs or cushions, you know, rolling the corners and stuff, you had some sore hands for a few days. But after you got good at it, I mean, the cushion would come to you, let's say, with all the pad and jute and all that stuff hog-rung onto the springs. And then the guy next to you would put a thin rubber pad on, and then we'd put the cover down, and I'd hog-rung it across the back and then flip the cushion over and pull up in the center with a hog ring and hook it to the frame.
What is a hog ring?
A hog ring is it's kind of a U-shaped thing that you push onto a wire or the binding in the around the cover, and then you squeeze it together. And we did, on certain jobs, you did them by hand, and I still have my hog ringer at home today that I used in the cushion room. And then, of course, we got high-tech and started making hog-ring guns. And they were run by air. And you had a strip of hog-rings that were shaped like a U, let's say, or a C. And you put slat them onto the gun, and then you push the cover up to where the wire was and pull the trigger, and it would squeeze a hog-ring for you.
Now, automation brought a little more danger, though. Can you tell me about that?
Oh, absolutely. You sometimes would come up with that gun and slip, or the cord would break on the cover, and you might hook one in your chin or one in your arm or your lip. Yeah, it brought some dangers. A lot of people fainted down there from running one in their arm and closing it up. And then somebody had to have a set of cutters to get it out. And I know the ladies were real prevalent to fainting always when they got one in them. They'd usually faint and hit the floor.
And what was the what was it like? Was there a lot of women in this cushion room?
Or? Oh, yes. The cushion room was mostly women in pad up and spring up and stuff where I started. But there was many more women when I first started there than there was men. But that was just prior to, or just after they had moved cut and sew out, because they used to make all the covers there in the cushion room also.
So you developed friendships with the people you worked around. Did you come a time where you considered them brothers and sisters?
Absolutely.
Can you tell me how did that develop?
Well, I think that if you're like UAW membership, you do a lot of things together. You go to union meetings together. You work together every day. And seemed to be everybody was brothers and sisters in there. And if one had a problem, we all had a problem. And of course, later on, there was always a few, you know, that kind of separated and come to the top, you know, sort of like the cream. There was a few of those that were a little better than everybody else. You know, they didn't have time to hobnob with us or drink a beer with us, or they were just snobbish, ornery people, I guess I called them. So those were kind of in a little clique of their own, you know, and we stayed away from them.
So you say they were cream. Maybe they were sediment.
Well, they might have, but sediment don't come to the top.
That's what I mean. Maybe they were actually on the bottom, huh? They just thought they were on top.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, they did think they were on top, but they weren't.
Have you developed friendships from there that extended outside the plant?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Ron Allman started at Cushion Room, see, and we've been friends for a lot of years, and we know his wife, and they live in Charlotte, and we live in Orleans, so we don't get together during the year, but I see them every year in Florida, every year. And, we tip a few colas, you know, and, some of soft drinks.
What did you do for lunch, and can you talk about what it was like to know a break was coming? Was it hard to keep up with the line? So what about breaks and lunches and stuff? What did you do when you hired him?
Well, if I remember right, we had like 2 8-minute breaks a day and 2 6-minute wagons. Wagons were coffee thing came around on a little cart with donuts and coffee and milk and stuff like that. We didn't have the pop or anything, but we had 2 of those a day. But the Cushion Room had 2 8-minute breaks because you couldn't smoke in the Cushion Room, so we'd take the break and go in that room and just puff our brains out, you know. And a lot of folks smoked back then, and it was just a cloud of blue, I'm telling you. But for lunch, I usually brown bagged it, but once in a while you go to the cafeteria. We had a 42-minute lunch back then, and then we kind of changed that, went to a half an hour because everybody wanted to get out earlier.
Okay. Was there departmental dinners, and did you participate come the holidays or other events that would happen?
Yes, we used to have a Thanksgiving one and a Christmas one. Everybody bring a dish to pass, and those that didn't want to bring a dish would throw in a few bucks, and some of the team would take or get ham or roast beef or turkey, and we'd have a nice layout for the holidays.
And you just worked right on around this food? And,
oh, yes.
And ate for 8 minutes?
Yeah,
or, of course, you had the lunch.
We would always figure out some way where the relief people, who relieve people from their job for emergency release and stuff, and they would set up tables beside the line or something, you know, or right down the aisle where they wouldn't have to run material trucks or something, and, or in the smoking room, we called it. But those were really a lot of fun.
Would you share a story about the Cushion department and some trouble happened? And would you share your story of that particular chain of events and what happened back then?
Yeah, I remember.
What year was that?
Seems to me like it was 1966, but I may be wrong. And seems to me like it was September 17th. And we had been fighting for pigskin gloves, really. And pigskin gloves were expensive. And, of course, they wanted to give us cloth gloves that were about 10 cents a pair or something. I mean, they didn't last at all. I thought it was crazy that they bought those because they didn't last at all, especially with the oily frames and sharp metal and stuff. And our union kept fighting for it. And I won't mention any names, but there was a few people got together and decided that we'll bring her to a head. Either they'll give us gloves or we'll shut it down. And I happened to be involved in that a little bit. And some awful stories started about me in that area, but they weren't all true. But I was involved in the Wildcat. And
what's a Wildcat?
Well, that's a unauthorized work stoppage. And
being unauthorized, meaning it wasn't approved by the international union?
That's
or the
right.
Local?
It's never been a strike vote on it or anything. It was not approved by the international. But we got some attention.
What happened? What did you do?
Well, we ended up getting a few gloves, and we went outside and walked the gates so they couldn't move the trucks. And the people didn't have any seats put in the cars, so they sent them home. And, of course, a lot of them then kind of congregated around the gate and stuff and out in the parking lot, and, you know, discussing the matter and whether it was good, bad, or indifferent. But it was kind of a wild night, to say the least.
And back then, did you with a work stoppage, did you still get paid, the other people?
I don't know. I think maybe the other people did. We didn't get paid.
Okay.
Well, I guess we did get paid. Some of us got disciplined.
That's what I was wondering now.
Yeah.
So did somebody take the wrath for that?
Yeah. There was some people got some pretty harsh punishment. I know Dorothy Stevens was one in that case, and I got a couple weeks myself. So it was really tough on me. As soon as they gave me the discipline, I went to Florida. But it was an interesting situation, and I learned a lot, brother. I learned a lot about that. And I don't think I'd ever do it again, not like that. But because that's the only blemish that was ever on my record here. And, well, you know, I lived through it. Thank God I did, but it's...
Well, you say it was a blemish, but you thought you did it for the right reason.
Yes, I thought I did it for the right reason, but it's still on my record. I mean, it was on my record that I had was involved in an illegal work stoppage. And, I probably would do it again, but I'd do it different. Let's put it that way.
Well, as we talk about that, then, would you please tell me about moving into the management role and what made you, when did you become a supervisor? And obviously, they... didn't think too less of you if they asked you to join the other side, the other
Well, I was always, I never missed it any time, ever. And I always did my job, even though I argued with certain people. One in particular I will tell you about in the cushion room was, I don't know if you guys know or heard of him, was Charlie Socher. That guy, I just absolutely could not get along with that guy. And I don't care how hard I worked for him or whatever, he just did not like me. And then after I'd left the cushion room and I went on salary and quality control on October 7th, 1968. And so now I am the quality control supervisor over all the inspectors, see? So I come to the cushion room to check something, and Charlie Socher runs over and throws his arm around my shoulder, and boy, I just think you're the greatest guy, and I'm so proud of you. And I said, get your hand off me. You wanted to walk on me like dirt when I worked for you, so don't touch me now. And him and I never, ever got along after that, or before, excuse me. That was the only supervisor that I ever really did not want him around me, touch me, anything, you know. And so he might have thought I was a real knucklehead, you know, when I told him to get his hands off me, don't touch me. But that's the way I felt. So, I transferred into quality control and did a good job for him. So my boss, Robert Martin, Bob Martin, and you probably heard of him. He was the night shift superintendent at the time. I did quality control, and he offered me the job, and I took it, and never looked back. And I retired in 1998 as a production superintendent on the chassis side.
I'm going to go back real briefly to you got your 89 days in a couple times. You said the gentleman that called you back said, "Rock, I got a job for you." Where'd Rocky come from? And obviously it was on early on, so why don't you share how you got that nickname?
When I was a young lad in Kentucky, I used to do some fighting, you know, for the school, and we had a little gym there in Kentucky. At that time it was Wicksburg, Kentucky, just over the hill from where I was born. And I had never been knocked down or anything. I'd lost a few fights on points, but I'd never been knocked down. So my coach started calling me Rockhead. And I don't know, it just kind of stayed with me. And then when I got to Michigan in 1955, I started working for this guy by the name of Jerry Yarger, who was a farmer in Diamonddale, and he had a stall on the Lansing vegetable market down there, at Shiawassee and Cedar.
City Market.
City Market, yes. And I started working for him, and he says to me one day, he says, "Where did you get a name of Wendell?" I said, "Well, my dad was an avid Republican. My grandfather was an avid Republican. And when Wendell Willkie was running for president in 1941, that's where I got the name." And I said, "My grandfather wanted to call me Wendell Willkie, but my dad said, 'No way you're putting Willkie in there, so I don't have a middle name.'" And so this Rocky just stuck with me from, I don't know, somebody mentioned it to somebody, and somebody started calling me Rockhead. Next thing you know, they're calling me Rocky, and it just hung with me the rest of my life. And everybody knows me as Rocky today. And I can go to my credit union and just sign Rocky, and they know who it is.
Really? You went into management. You say you went right fairly moved. Just a moment here. Jerry Smith.
Yes, Rocky, seeing how you worked on the line as a line worker and then went into supervision, how did you and the committee people get along after the transformation?
Well, I thought we got along quite well. There was certain committee men that you had a tough, tough time with, and that's when I became tough. You know, if you want to be reasonable with me, I'll be reasonable with you. You start trying to walk on me, I'm going to get on top of you one way or another. And, yes, we had Curly Jones and I have had some trying times, but I never gave in to Curly Jones without a fight. And it doesn't make any difference if I'm a committee man or a salary man. I'm still going to fight for what I think is right. I've had some very good relationships with people like Don Brown when he was on shop committee, and I never had any problem with many other committee men, but Curly Jones and I just didn't see eye to eye. But we didn't see eye to eye when I had repair up in 3X, and Curly Jones was a repairman either. Because to be very honest with you, I thought Curly Jones, when he came to work, was so tired he couldn't do his job because he was fireman, you know. And maybe that was the reason, but him and I were head-to-head most of the time. And then when he went on committee, we didn't change much. We're not great friends yet, but we still hobnob together a little bit in Florida. But I tried to be honest and true. I mean, I tried to tell the people what I thought was right, and I never had a lot of people, problems while I was managing. Yes, there was. I mean, I had some pretty tough questions for the committeemen sometimes, you know, like, why do you spend 98% of your time with 5% of the workforce? Because we had such good people, and then we'd have, you know, like a lump in the sugar box. You'd have just a few, you know, that caused you problems all the time, didn't show up for work, drunk on the job, or whatever. And that always just absolutely blew my mind why we spend, me too, you know, because I spent a lot of my time with those problem people. We spent 98% of our time with 3-5% of the workforce, rather than us going up and telling Doug Rademacher, you just did a fine job today, I hope you have a nice evening. We didn't have time for that because we're talking to the guy that didn't come to work Monday, don't come to work on Friday, especially in night shift. You paid him on Thursday night and then you didn't see him Friday night. You know, we had a few of those. And then I won't mention one committeeman. I called him one day, or one night. I was a night shift superintendent for quite some time in trim. And I called this committeeman up and I said, get down to the office right now. I've got one down here, the real live one. What's the matter? I said, he's drunk. He can't stay on the chair. He said, just call a cab and send him home. I said, uh-uh. Yeah, I'm not getting no lawsuit out of this one, pal. Come on down here. So he comes down, and now I got two drunks. This committee man was as drunk as the guy he's going to represent. So, obviously, I got another committee man, and we disciplined both of them. And plant security took one of them home. I don't know what happened to the other one. But, man, they were both messed up. And but we had some real encounters around contract time. Union representation always try to protect their people, and management always try to protect their people also. And there was times when we got rid of some bad apples on discharging them. You know, I remember a little guy from Albion by the name of Fred Whitney. We sprayed headlinings up in 3X. And this Fred Whitney, I mean, which is a really dumb thing to do, he walks through and throws a firecracker in FS 1120, and that was that old yellow glue, you know, that we sprayed on headlinings. A flash point is so low on that, it's pathetic. And fortunately, we didn't have a fire, but he could have blown that building up because we had barrels of it around there, you know. I discharged him, and he's one that never came back. He threatened my family, threatened me, everything, but he never came back because, boy, he really put some people in jeopardy that night. And I don't know why he did it, but he just thought it was going to be funny if we had a little fire in that booth, you know. It was really dumb. But that's just some of the things you encounter with some of these people. And but when you had people out for absenteeism and what have you, discharged, and contract time come up, you know, of course the union's going to try to get those people back. And most of the time they did. But again, they just brought the problem back and we fought with it for another 3 years, you know. Because those people, a lot of them never made it. They had problems and they just couldn't correct them. We couldn't either, I guess. And you probably have some of those today.
Absolutely. There are some new changes in the national agreement to continue to help make it easier to get rid of that people. And that always has been our effort to protect our workers. Cheryl McQuaid.
Rocky, what did you feel made a good employee?
A good employee was one that came in and, you know, he didn't have to get involved in anything else, but he did his job, did it right. If he didn't do it right, he let somebody know that he didn't get it done right, because the ultimate customer out there wants it right when he buys a car. And, you know, for years we had salaried people that keep pushing the people, you know, to get it out, get it out, get it out. Don't have to be right, you know, get it out. And guess what? Look where we're at today because of that. Because we did ship some bad quality for a long time, but then we improved, but it was a little bit late. But a good employee was one that came in and did his job, and if he wanted help with anything, he wasn't afraid to ask, and those type of people, you weren't afraid to help them either. And they need to be to work every day, you know, unless you're deathly ill, you need to be to work every day, because we depend on somebody to be on that job every day. And it's so much easier on everybody if everybody is here on every day. And I don't care if you're a what they call a absentee replacement, a utility guy, a relief guy, or what. You don't do that job like the guy that does it every day, day in, day out. So absenteeism was probably one of our worst problems we had. Well, we had some, but we had bad salary people too. Don't get me wrong. It wasn't just the hourly folks. We had a lot of people that just lived on numbers. And some of them were pretty high positions. And I don't know why that we have to do business that way, but it's not right.
When you say lived on numbers, are you talking about headcount or workload or whatever? What do you mean?
Headcount, workload, buy rates, shipping rates. I mean, there's a chart of numbers like the calendar there, you know. If you got... If you didn't have 85% buy rate at the end of the line, you're not running. You know, it's just too much repair going up there. And I don't know. There was attitudes from some of the salary just didn't care, you know, that whether we got it done or not, just get it out the door. And a lot of those are not around anymore, or weren't when I left. But some of those went bye-bye, even though they were salary.
What was your relationship with the skilled trades?
Very good, very good. I had a lot of friends in maintenance and skilled trades. Like Lynn Borman and I are very good friends. I had a tinsmith down there that we used to do a lot of stuff together, and I got his daughters hired in here at one time, Lloyd Wolliver. That guy was the most talented tin man I've ever seen. He could make anything out of tin. And if I needed anything in trim, might not have been the right thing to do, but he'd go around his regular job and get that done for me. We were just good friends, you know, and he's quite a guy. He was never able to have kids, yet he adopted a couple of girls, and boy, there have been a lot of problems for him, and I've tried to help him out with it. I got him a job, but one of them took the buyout, and the other one, she has all kinds of other problems, and I think maybe the drugs and booze might be the biggest problem, but I feel so sorry for him, because they did so well with those kids, or tried to give them everything they wanted, and just never came to grips with it. The kids, I mean.
I want to take you back. The Fisher brothers purchased the building. They have what's recognized as the body by Fisher as a coach. Can you tell me about the Fisher coach and something that you might have done?
Well, I remember, and again, I don't even remember what year it was, but we were down for changeover. And usually at changeover, I'd take the first 2 weeks vacation, you know, and we were going to be down 4 to 5 weeks that time, so I took the first 2 weeks, and I come back, and Bob Martin, who was the guy that hired me in quality control, he met me at the door, and he had a drawing as big as that chart you have up there, maybe as big as that board.
So about a 4x5?
Yeah, something like that, with a hand drawing of the coach that he had drawn. And he met me at the door with it, and he says, I got a project for you here, and I need it in 2 weeks. I looked at that and I said, holy man, what do you mean do? Color it? And he says, no. He was the second man under the plant manager at that time. He was the production manager at that time. And he says, I've been told that you're one of the best woodworkers around. And he says, I want you to build this coach, a life-size coach that we can put some kids in for the parade downtown Lansing. holy mackerel, that's quite a job. He said, yeah, but you can do it. And he says, we've already been to the union and got an okay that you can work on this, and we have a room set up for you and everything. So I go over there, and while I was on vacation, they had went to Indiana and bought a Amish buggy. And they had it back there, and we took the cab off of it. And I started measuring everything, and I said, Bob, you're going to have to cut this frame and extend it 2 feet before we can get the front seat on it, you know. So we did that, and got that all welded up and ready to go, and I got a few guys lined up. Most of them were salaried just to run to the hardware and get parts or what have you, and John Jansen's in labor relations. He was one of those runners. And I'm going to tell you the whole story. So anyway, I get a guy over in layout, Jerry. He was a carpenter, not layout. He was a carpenter in maintenance, Jerry somebody. He has since passed away. But I got him over there, and I showed him what I needed. I said, I want these things turned on a lathe, you know, and put together for putting the eagles on top of it and all of that. And so he said, yeah, I can do that. And I said, okay. So we went into it, and I started putting the thing together, and then we had to get some people to do a little sewing. You know, we had Judy that was married to the general foreman in quality control, or material. I almost had it on the end of my tongue. But anyway, she did the sewing and built the, made the skirt thing on the back and the skirt that went around the seat. And so I just started cutting, putting it together, and then I framed all the windows and everything and upholstered the outside. And like I said, I had a few people helping me, like Dean Croston from Trim. He did some welding on it, and on the frame and stuff, and made the seat frame and all that. And then I decided, well, we've got to have doors that open and close here. And I built these doors and put locks and stuff in them, and they just, I mean, they sound like an old Cadillac, you know, back in the 40s. Click, you can hear it, thing works so good. And then I upholstered the entire inside and never put a thread of needle in it. I took staples and stapled ribs in it, and then took a broomstick and wrapped it in material and put it up through there and put finished nails up through it, and you couldn't see it, and it really turned out great. And I took this gold rope. We went somewhere and bought this gold rope, and I trimmed out all the glass and bought the moldings for the top of it, bought the eagles. I think we paid like $50 a piece for those eagles for it. And then we got her all finished. I finished it on Thursday, and we're going to run it in a parade on Saturday. And we won a judge's trophy with it, and everybody in the town, I think, had their picture taken by it. Or we had three kids, John Jansen's one kid, and one of material supervisors, two kids were dressed like the pilgrim dress, you know, and the black and white and the dresses and all that. And they rode in it with, and we got a guy out of Williamson that brought an identical set of Morgans and pulled that thing down through town. And John Jansen was the pooper scooper, riding a little scooter behind it, you know, and a bucket and a shovel. That, good job for him. But that was quite an experience, and it just turned out great. And it's that thing. We took that to Detroit to the tech center for about 2 or 3 months, and then they wanted to put it in the archives down here, so they stored it in the basement at Fisher for quite a while. And last time I checked, it was downtown. So
used to sit in the audit, Jerry. Oh, yeah. Used to sit in the audit area, because when I came in the plant in '94, it was in the audit area down there before they changed the front of the plant.
Yeah, we built a special room right for it there, and had all the history of it in there. Whatever happened to that? I wonder if the books are with it.
Don't know that I have. I think it's at the Arioles Museum downtown Lansing.
I'm going to go down one of these days and see. But that was quite an experience.
Now, just out of curiosity, did the Fisher brothers ever see or know of it? Anybody of the Fisher family, or is that?
I haven't any clue unless they saw it at the tech center. Okay. But I got a lot of accolades for that.
Well, the plant, known as Fisher Body, changed names many times. Mm. What's it to you? What is it? You left and went over to the chassis side. What is this plant?
I left Fisher Body and went to the chassis plant in October of, or August, I mean, of 1985. And it is still Fisher Body to me today. I mean, you can take the boy out of Fisher, but you can't take the Fisher out of the boy.
Cheryl McQuaid?
Rocky, did you ever see anybody hurt in the plant?
Absolutely.
Any stories you want to share with us?
Well, I was one of them. If you remember how we moved cars around in building 5 upstairs there, where they came out of 3X, and then they go through this transfer, you know, and then head down to building 17. And we were having a problem with where the tracks change, you know, to shift the cars. We had a problem, couldn't get it to go, and maintenance is up there, and I'm up there, and of course, I was a superintendent on nights at that time, and we were about to shut Olds down because we didn't have cars over there, you know, because of all the problems, and so the maintenance guys are jacking it up and trying to move this car over, and one of them says, hold that wheel straight so it'll go down in the track. And I'd reach in and grab it, but I grabbed it too low, and it just smashed this finger, and it's still dead, you know. It still hurts. But that was just a minor injury. I've seen guys caught between cars, and then I didn't see the guy, the Steve... somebody that got killed over in the shipping building over there. They were trying to pull a bunch of body trucks up or something, and the cable broke, and the thing hit him and killed him. That was quite a few years ago. And then I've seen guys get, like we had a stack of quarter panels in a body shop. A stack was on a rack with wheels on it. Probably had 20 quarter panels on it, and the strap around it broke, and one of the quarter panels fell out and hit this guy in the back of the leg, and I mean, it was gashed and the blood just pouring, so I ripped my shirt off and tied it around his leg until they got there, you know. And but yeah, I've seen a few people hurt. A lot of hog rings when I was in the cushion room, and I've seen people hit themselves in the chin, and hog ring would be in the chin, but it hit that bone, and man, that's got to hurt. I've seen them in the nose, the lips, and I'll tell you what, you don't stop pulling the trigger when it hits you either. It just automatically hit the trigger, and that closes it up. Now you can't get rid of it. You got to cut it.
Another question I have, Rocky, is you worked in the cushion room, quality control, and you were a superintendent. What other departments did you work in the plant?
Well, I worked, I started out in the cushion room, went to quality control. I was a quality control for about a year and a half, and Phil Darber was the trim superintendent at that time. He came to me and he says, how would you like to jump ship and go back to trim? So I don't know what you got to offer. He says, I'd like to promote you to a 7th level and put you in trim. I said, yeah, I can handle that. You know, a bit more money and more responsibility. And so I transferred into trim. Then I was, quality control came back and wanted me to come back to quality control. And so I went back to quality control and became a general supervisor over quality control, and I stayed with that for a while, and then I went back to trim again as our eighth level, night shift. And then I started replacing the night shift superintendent in the entire plant. So I had paint, body, trim, cushion, the whole works. I did that quite often. All the vacations and stuff, I would replace them. And then in 85, I went to Building 90, production superintendent, traded jobs with Randy Thayer. And then I stayed in there for 5 years, and I went to the center plant, which was engine dress, wheel room, and paint repair, Building 150. And then I was up there for 3 years, and then Bill Bingle came to me, and he says, I'd like to give you an eighth-level job in material handling. I said, well, I've never worked material handling before. He said, well, I'd like to have you come to work for me. So I said, okay. So I go to material handling, and then Randy Walter, who was the area manager at the time over there, he came to me, and he says, Rocky says, I've got troubles down in wheel room. I got troubles in engine dress and fascia paint. He said, if you come back to center plant, get it running. He says, I know you want to retire, so I'll see that you get a mutual. I said, okay, Randy, I'll be back. And a year after that, I was gone. So I've been all over the place.
And you solved that problem before you went?
Yes, I did.
Rocky, I know you're on a time limit today. I just wanted a quick story. You were obviously an Oldsmobile enthusiast. You had a pretty white car. You want to tell a little story about that real quick? Or you remember that?
Yeah. You mean that little 69 convertible?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was I put a lot of money in it, but it was a beauty. And we were, you talked about when I was over the huddle that night?
Well, I don't know about so
oh,
much.
Just, oh, there's two stories.
Well, that's fine. I know that story. I just, we were, you had a need, and I happen to be an Olds enthusiast also, so I, it's your story. You got something you needed?
And, well, yeah, and you know what? I can't even remember for sure how it all went. You probably could enlighten me, but I did have a very nice 69 convertible, and the engine wasn't very good in it, so I needed a 455 engine, and we got that. And I didn't get it from here. We didn't have any. But, boy, it's hard to remember all the stuff that went on.
Well, I got you some exhaust chrome bells for your bumper. But,
oh, yes. That was when I put that 455 Tornado engine in, and you got those bells for me, yes. And God, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. But one thing I did do was I was over to the Huddle Lounge one night after we got out of work, and these guys were talking about, oh, that white convertible, it's pretty, but it ain't got no guts and all this, you know. And so when the bar closed and everybody was gone but me and two other guys, we had a little bet over there. And I backed up right to the edge of the parking lot, and I burnt rubber all the way to the drive. And the guys, they shut up then. And next time I'm in there, Dick that owned the place, he was beside himself. He said, you got to get rid of these black marks on my parking lot.
How are you doing? You look great. Good.
I feel good.
Rocky, you've retired. You've been out for a while. Lansing Fisher Body is now being disassembled as we speak. What's your feelings about that? What's your comments about the future for Lansing? You mentioned Randy Thayer. Would you just close up this last couple minutes here and talk about that?
Well, I have a couple of spies in Lansing that keep emailing me with pictures of while the destruction is going on. And Randy Thayer also is a very good friend of mine, and he keeps sending me pictures of the plant as they progress in the construction and getting it ready to go. And I have a son-in-law, ex-son-in-law, that works over there, and so he always calls me, too, and tells me what's going on. So I still have quite an interest in what's going on, but I know from my experience that Lansing will succeed. If there are any cars built anywhere, they will be built in Lansing because of the workforce we have here and the relationship between the unions and management has improved considerably, both 602 and 652. And I know that if cars are built in Michigan, they will be building them here in Lansing. And I don't think you can beat the workforce in Lansing. I mean, we struggled for a while and forgot what we were there for, I guess, but we learned. And when we did finally figure out what we were doing wrong, we became one of the best there was. And we became a great team, I thought. And I always felt really good about how I was received when I walked up and down the line. And I was always out there on the line. I didn't spend my days in the office. And if I had to get something done, if I had to pull 5% of the people or whatever, I did my best to do it, but I wouldn't talk to everybody before we did it. And we would come to some kind of a conclusion that was good for both of us. And I always enjoyed my job. And I'll always be Fisher Body, and I'll always be GM. And I don't drive anything but GM, and neither do my kids or my son-in-laws, or they don't drive anything but GM. Makes me sick to go to Florida and see all the foreign cars, Toyotas, Hondas, Nissans, Infinities, just sickening because there are not many American cars in Florida. And we need to, the American people are fickle people, I tell you. It's they don't know what they're doing to this country by the automobile route. And we got some politicians, too. I get pretty upset with Granholm sometimes with the way she talks about the automotive industry. Well, we don't need them. We can go high tech. Well, sure, yeah, you can. But how long do you think it's going to last, you know? I mean, I have a son-in-law, or a grandson, and I would love to have him hire in General Motors, but that probably won't ever happen anymore. And he struggles in school because he doesn't like school, but he's not dumb. He's smart, but I don't know. He's going to be a mechanic, I guess, because he wouldn't be able to get in a GM or anything like that. And I always wanted to have that, and we used to have it. There was nothing to get your kids in here or whatever. But believe me, some of the supervisors' kids were a problem, too, let me tell you. Had a lot of them work for me. But I enjoyed my career. It was a long career, and I truly miss the people. I really do. And that's about all I can tell you about it. Well, there's a lot more stories, but we ain't got enough time in the day.
I know that's true. And, I've only known you as management. I knew the stories of your past coming up from the line, and we really appreciate you taking the time in your retirement years to come over and share your stories with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.